Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on Behind the Knife, we are bringing you another special episode from the recent visit to the Academic Surgical Congress. We have Drs. Craig Kent and Michael Englesby. And during the conference, we were able to sit down with them for a more extended session. So we combined both the podcasts into one large, awesome podcast. And I hope you guys enjoy.
Okay, we're back at the ASC meeting, the 11th annual, 2016. We're here with Dr. Craig Kent. He's the A.R. Carreri Professor of Surgery and the Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin. He's also a vascular surgeon. Dr. Kent, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And for those of you that are those out there that don't know, I wonder if you could just give us a brief background, where you trained, where you're at right now, and what your typical clinical practice is currently.
Sure. Well, I trained in general surgery at University of California, San Francisco, and then went off to Brigham and Women's Hospital for my vascular fellowship. And then I was on faculty at Beth Israel Deaconess for a number of years, went to New York then to be chief of the Division of Vascular Surgery at Cornell and Columbia. And then for the past 7 years, I've been in Wisconsin as a chairman of the Department of Surgery.
And as we were walking with you in the elevators today, we heard multiple people nudging us out of the way to tell us how great your talk was today. And so I was hoping for our listeners that couldn't make it to the meeting today, didn't quite make it to that talk, if you give us a little rundown of what you talked to about, to the surgeons about today.
Well, thanks. Sharon Weber, who is this year's president of the Society of University Surgeons, is from the University of Wisconsin, an outstanding individual, and we're so proud that she represented our institution as president of the society. She asked me to give a talk about the future of surgical research. And anybody that knows me knows that I have this incredible passion for surgical research. I've been a funded basic science investigator for about 20 years now, and actually in the past few years have been funded for health services research. So I really enjoy this aspect of it, and it's something that I brought to the Department of Surgery at University of Wisconsin. We're very strong in research and have about $20 million of peer-reviewed funding each year. So anyway, that's the background. One of the things that I enjoy when I get invited for visiting professorships or lectures around the country is to share my passion and enthusiasm for research. And it's interesting because I think it's become more and more difficult over the years to sustain a program as a funded surgical researcher. In my talk today, we went through some of the issues that have come along. Of course, NIH funding is not as robust now as it has been in the past. But the other side of it, which is almost more important, is that surgeons turn out to be really important to their local institutions. They're important to the CEOs because they generate revenue and margin from the cases they do. So the CEOs would rather see the surgeons in the operating room than in the research laboratories. And even deans, who of course love research, it turns out that it's more expensive to have a surgeon get an R01 grant than it is to have a pediatrician just because of the salary difference. So there's a lot of pressure for surgeons, you know, not to be involved in academic efforts and to be in the operating room. So that's a bit of the challenge. Alternatively, you know, if you look through, you know, the history of research, a lot of the really innovative and extraordinary accomplishments have been made by surgeons. Surgeons actually are this kind of hard-driving, perseverant personality that adapts very nicely and quickly to research. We're actually really smart too, and we've made a lot of really great discoveries over the years. And it's interesting because somebody has to do research in the surgical disciplines, right? Somebody has to do that. And so if we decide to relegate that to, you know, somebody as an internal medicine physician or a PhD, then we won't even be leading our own specialty. So that, you know, the majority of the talk was focused on that there are tools and ways that you can go about still being a funded and very successful surgical research. There's lots of opportunities. One of those is that although basic science used to be an important part of surgical research, and it still is for some, a lot of surgical research now is health services and clinical research. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge amount of funding for that because there's a lot of focus on quality and cost, right, and in all of our systems, and we have to figure out how to improve cost and improve quality for our surgical patients. And so what a wonderful thing to study, right? Mm-hmm. And so great opportunities for surgeons in that regard. So you know, at the end of the day, it was pep talk. It was a cheerleading talk, trying to make people excited about surgical research, that there is a future for it. And my crystal ball predicts that we're going to do well, and there's going to be lots of research in the future.
Well, the pep talk seemed to work. People were very excited, it seems, so that's great. I was wondering, transitioning now, if you could talk to us a little bit about you run a basic science lab, and are doing a lot of work as far as why grafts and fail why. Angioplasty fail. If you could talk to us a little bit about some of the challenges, what you're working on, what kind of results you're finding, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Well, thanks for asking. Getting back to surgeons doing research, I think the ones that are most successful are the ones that go to the operating room and find a problem, and then they go back to the laboratory and they try to solve that problem. I actually believe that surgeons are in a much better position to translate than most of the other medical disciplines. So, as a vascular surgeon, having been involved in bypasses for 20 some years, the good news is they're fun to make and they save legs and they save arms and all kinds of organs. The bad news is they clog up again, mm-hmm. right? And it's a little frustrating, because you've gone to all this work and you've done a great bypass, then it occludes again and you're right back to where you started, or maybe even worse off. And so trying to figure out what is the cause of restenosis and whether there are drugs or therapies that can be given at the time of the initial bypass to prevent the disease from coming back is really been the overarching goal of my basic research over quite a number of years. And so we've explored a number of different cellular signaling pathways. The bad guy in all of this is the vascular smooth muscle cell that's supposed to be in the media of the artery. Yeah. But then after a bypass or after an angioplasty, it gets all stirred up. And what it does is it goes into the subintimal space, and then these cells keep proliferating and they produce matrix. And all of a sudden there's a big plaque, and the plaque narrows the lumen and the vessel blocks. So if you can figure out how to tame down that smooth muscle cell to make it not get stirred up, more specifically to stop it from proliferating and migrating and producing matrix, then you're going to solve the problem. So, over the years I've studied why smooth muscle cells grow or proliferate. We've gotten very much into the complex signaling pathways, and we've used a variety of different molecular techniques to inhibit those pathways that cause proliferation, with a fair amount of success in animal models. We've come up with a number of different inhibitors that have been really very useful. We have patents on a few, and at University of Wisconsin we have a great system for translating, so a couple of those patents we're taking beyond, and hopefully in a few years we'll be able to create a solution that'll work. Another area that I'm really interested in is drug delivery. And it's interesting. Now, if you do a bypass on somebody, there are some drugs that stop restenosis, but we don't have any way of giving those drugs at the time of bypass surgery. Actually, they're on stents, so you can give them at the time of an angioplasty, but there's no way to give them at the time of bypass surgery. So we're doing some really innovative work around using drugs and nanoparticles to sort of sprinkle the nanoparticles on the bypass graft, and they're with a drug, and the drug stops restenosis, and we're about ready to move into human clinical trials with some of our nanoparticle work.
Oh, great. Well, at ASC here, you definitely find a lot of the surgical scientists around, and the question we have for a lot of people is, how do you balance that time between your clinical and your scientific time? Is it, do you split time during the week, or is it, what drives you to do that basic science back to lab work?
Well, I'll answer your first question, your second question first. I what drives me to do that? I think surgeons that are involved in research are just passionate about it. They just enjoy research. They enjoy, creating new things and making discoveries. And if you're going to be successful, you really have to have that passion, because it does require a lot of work. And so it's Saturday morning or, it's Friday evening, and, that work needs to be done. If you're not passionate about it, it's not going to get done. So I think passion's really important. I'm fairly senior, and I've been funded for a lot of years. And so when you get in that situation and you've have a fair amount of grant funding coming in, then you can build this huge infrastructure. And so I have this, you know, infrastructure of PhDs and residents and fellows and people that keep the research going, even if I'm in Jacksonville, you know, going to the AAS. And so you know, for me, it's a fairly automatic at this point. But I think it's more of a struggle for younger people that are just getting started, getting their career development awards and trying to get their first grants. For those people, it's really challenging. I think getting into an environment where there's a great team. So when you're doing your research, there are people that'll take care of your patients. And while you're taking care of patients, somebody else can do their research. I think teams are really important. Getting into an environment where the culture is one that advocates for research, you know, so people understand the value of research and embrace that and reward it. And it's not always economic rewards, but just culturally that they reward it. I think a third part is just being an incredibly efficient person. I mean, there's some people that can, you know, have six balls up in the air all at the same time, and there are others that can't. And it's a matter of being able to think about two or three things at a time, recruiting some great people to work with and around you to help things, you know, keep moving forward despite the fact that you're not ever present. So efficiency, being in a great culture, being resourced, all those things I think are critically important to success.
Well, speaking of juggling many balls at one time, you were saying that earlier that you're actually involved with in the broad public health scheme of Wisconsin as a whole. And I was hoping you'd talk to us a little bit about the crisis in rural surgery, and especially in Wisconsin, how it applies to America. And not only the crisis, but how do you foresee us addressing that with training surgery residents? Because now they're saying that, we've talked to multiple people today that say, really, you pretty much have to go into a fellowship if you want to be in a big city, be in an academic center. And I feel like those are kind of contradictory messages that we're getting.
Sure. Well, this is a bit of a new area for me. I've been in Wisconsin for the past 7 years, and before that in very large cities. But, you know, I'm chair of a department in a state institution in a state that's lacking rural surgeons. And so it becomes my problem to try to figure out how to solve that. And, you know, UW... Department of Surgery is a very academic department. We have a lot of funding, a lot of research individuals, and a lot of our residents that track through there are going into academics and spend time in research. So we really weren't solving that problem for the state of Wisconsin. So what we decided to do was to create a new rural residency track. And it's sort of an interesting idea. So somebody tracks into the rural slot. They don't go into our usual residency, but it's actually a separate RRC spot. And they'll spend, of the 5 years, a little over 3 years at UW, but almost 2 years at institutions around the state. And the places that they go are where there are rural surgeons practicing. You know, and some of the places are, you know, busy community surgeons. In other places, there's an individual surgeon that's you know, setting hand fractures and doing hysterectomies. And so what happens is that there's a whole knowledge base that you learn in the rural community in terms of what practice is like. There's skill sets that you need to learn, and the individuals that go through this track will, you know, gain access to that skill set. But the other part of this that I think is really unique and important is one of the reasons that nobody goes to a rural environment, they might come from it in the first place, and they might go to medical school with the intent of going back to the rural environment, but then they train at an academic institution in a fairly large city, maybe they meet their spouse at that institution, then they feel a little insecure when they come out of training, so that they then go off and do a fellowship at another academic institution, and by the time, you know, how many years is that, 7, 9 mm-hmm. years, you know, depending on what track you take, most people then, you know, have left, you know, the rural world behind and really are not anxious, or their spouse is not anxious to go back. On the other hand, if we train people in the rural environment, I mean, if they live 2 out of the 5 years in that rural environment, they're going to be eager to go back to that because that's where they train and that's where their life is. And in fact, I suspect many of these rural environments will recruit these individuals back. So you mentioned Tyler Hughes as somebody that had been on the podcast before. Tyler and I, Karen Brazel at University of Oregon, are having conversations about, could we get CMS to pay for, let's just say, 50 rural training programs around the country. And we take academic medical centers in places, you know, states that need rural surgery, and, you know, and get the federal government to pay, you know, for the slots for 50 of those. So then it turns out every year, 50 new people who are extraordinarily interested in rural surgery go out, you know, across our nation and fill this void that's really so important. And I will say the first year we had this, we actually had 100 people apply for one slot, okay? And we, you know, interviewed about 20 individuals, and we picked the person that we thought was most likely at the end of training to go back into a rural environment. So I think this is going to be really, really successful. So, you know, we're in our third year now, and it takes so long in surgery for anything to evolve through and, you know, find out what the output is. But I think this is an interesting concept, and we hope that we can expand it beyond Wisconsin.
So, sir, one segment we like to do with our expert surgeons is what we call a tips and tricks section. And since it seems to be one of your subspecialties is bypass, I was wondering if you can give us some tips. You know, I'm about to start a vascular rotation this month, actually, and we'll be doing a lot of fem-pop bypasses. Can you give me some tips for suturing in those anastomoses to make them the most successful as possible?
Sure. Well, if it's your first time on a vascular rotation, what I would suggest as you're getting ready for the rotation is to sneak in the operating room and steal a Castro Viejo needle holder. Yep. And then take along with you about 10 packets of 6-0 and 7-0 suture. And then find anything. It could be Kleenex, you know, it could be two pieces of paper, and just create suture line after suture line after suture line. And you know what, it's interesting, it actually is not that hard to sew with a Castro Viejo needle holder. It is when you're first trying to do it. You know, you need some loops to be able to see. But after you get the rhythm, it actually goes very, very well. And one of the things that happens, and I'm sure many of your other people on the podcast have mentioned this, but if you walk into the operating room, and let's say you're doing a carotid endarterectomy with me, and you already know how to use that Castro, you will sew both sides of the patch. That's what'll happen. Because, you know, the operation has to move along, and if I'm showing you how to mount the needle on the Castro and the needle's going in backwards, you know, then you know, you don't end up doing too much of the case. But it's one of those things that we talk about simulation and how important it is. Well, this is better than simulation. I mean, you're doing an anastomosis outside the operating room, and to the point that you get so good at it, when you get in the operating room, the surgeon's really comfortable letting you go forward with that. That's my best advice before you go into a distal bypass.
Excellent. So as we mentioned, we're at the 11th annual ASC meeting. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what the Academic Surgical Congress has meant to you throughout your career, why people should be involved in it.
Well, it's interesting. I've spent a lot of this conversation talking about research, but academics is so much larger than that. It's about training, right? It's about building strong clinical programs. It's about tertiary quaternary care, and it's about clinical research, and it's about basic science research. And I see the AAS and the SUS as two organizations that have allowed individuals that have interest in all of the above to celebrate, you know, once a year at the national meeting, all of their accomplishments and share and collaborate with each other in terms of, you know, how to be successful as an academic surgeon. And so, you know, when I first started, you know, the goal was to, as quickly as possible, get into the AAS, and far more important than that was to figure out how to get my first abstract on the meeting. And it was so exciting that, you know, the very first meeting I think I went to in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and I got up in front of this very large group and, you know, didn't stutter and fall down and was able to give my presentation. And so it's sort of a rite of passage, right? And then the Society of University Surgeons is sort of the next level where you have to achieve a certain level of prominence to get in. The day the email, actually I expect it was probably a letter back then, came to tell me that I'd been inducted into the Society of University of Surgeons. It was a great honor. You know, and for me now at a more senior stage of my career, it's just so much fun to come here. And I'm told that there are 1,500 people at this meeting to watch 1,500 people from every academic institution in the country just celebrate the success that they've had in research and academic medicine over the past year. It's rewarding to see that we're thriving and doing so well in academic surgery. So I think these organizations are absolutely fantastic. This meeting is a must, you know, for anybody that has an interest in academic medicine and in the end, a great celebration.
And so what we've been closing out every interview with today is a question of, if you could go back in time and meet yourself on your first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
You know, I would give myself a piece of advice that I actually figured out in the first day of my internship. And that was just enjoy yourself and have fun. And that's how my career has been. When I showed up the first day, I was going to become a surgeon. I mean, my gosh, how many people in the world get a chance to be surgeons? And so I felt like I was the most privileged person in the world to be given that opportunity. And I came to work every day excited and eager to learn and eager to be the best I could. And then, you know, when I finished and my fellowship was done and I started my academic career, every day was an exciting new day with a new opportunity. And I've had a great career. I've enjoyed every moment of it. It hasn't been pre-planned. It's just been trying to do things that I enjoy and do them well. And the reward has been a lot of success over the years. So I think, you know, the message is just get out there and enjoy it, and you'll have a great life.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife. We are privileged to have Michael J. Englesby, Associate Professor of Surgery in the Section of Transplantation Surgery at University of Michigan. We also heard a great talk from Dr. Englesby yesterday on Failing Forward, which we'll be publishing in the near future. Sir, welcome to have you.
My pleasure. Mm-hmm.
So I guess where we're going to get started, and one of the reasons we asked you to come on the podcast today, is talk about something kind of unique to our podcast we never had, and that is the preoperative optimization. And I know you had this project, it's been published in multiple different news articles, the MSHOP project. Can you kind of explain that to us a little bit?
Thank you for letting me talk about it. So I guess the analogy I use is, you know, if we go into the waiting room and look at patients that we all operate on, my practice is liver transplantation, but, you know, just see who we operate on and kind of ponder the how kind of physiologically draining a big operation is. So a 2-hour laparotomy is about as hard on a patient as them running a 5K race as fast as they can go. So, you know, go to the waiting room and ponder anyone doing a 5K in that waiting room. So within that context, we got into two domains. One is using kind of data to make better decisions about who to and not operate on and how to titrate care. And then two is to essentially train patients. So we've been doing this in Ann Arbor for about 4 years, and we've trained about 1,000 patients. We run it through our preoperative clinic, and now we are doing it across the state of Michigan. In hopefully 40 hospitals. Right now we're in 12 hospitals. And essentially what it is, you come in and we have a bunch of kind of technology where we have risk assessment tool. It's like there's a NISQIP calculator. It's very similar, but it's just kind of on a mobile device because we have a collaborative in the state of Michigan. We use the back-end data for that. And we have data pretty much on every operation that we do. And it gives us, like, it almost looks like a speedometer, like your risk goes from like 0 to 100. And it's a great tool to talk to patients about. So, you know, Mr. Smith, you're going 87 miles an hour. You know, high risk. This is what I'd say, colectomy is high risk. And then try to intervene. And we started off really trying to intervene on the higher risk patients. We kind of started just kind of offering training for everyone. But say, hey, Mr. Smith, you know, we have a month between now and when we're going to do your operation. Let's see if we can get your quote optimized or prepared. And it's an amazing thing because patients are scared. I think the unique thing about being a surgeon, I've always appreciated in my liver transplant practices, patients do anything I say. I think that's a different dynamic because they're scared and it's a vulnerable time for them. And they're, you know, this potentially is the most kind of important thing that's ever happened to them, having, you know, cancer or needing a transplant or needing to have a heart surgery or whatever the case may be. So they're essentially uniquely kind of engaged and locked in. So we've had a lot of success. 85% of patients we asked to participate, and of those, 91% essentially do the program. The program is they get a pedometer, they walk, incentive spirometer, and do some nutrition stuff. They have to quit smoking. And we slowly re-enhance more. We are kind of throwing more stuff into the program. So yeah, we've trained about 1,000 patients, and I think most importantly, it's a great thing for the patients. All the feedback we get is very positive. It's very empowering, and I think that's how it works. I think it's the physiology of it you know, we've tried to study that. I don't think that has essentially is the magic sauce. I think the magic sauce is mostly patient engagement, patient empowerment. And they, you know, they get a daily text. They feel that, you know, the program's taking care of them. How far did you walk today? Great job. Yada, yada, yada. And yeah, I mean, it's good. It reduces length of stay. It's reduced costs a good bit. And it's becoming standard of care at our institution in Ann Arbor. And then we have a grant from Medicare to kind of expand it across the state. So,
and that was kind of what I was going to ask next is, it seems resource intensive, and very, you'd have to have a lot of buy-in from the institution to kind of follow up and put a program like this in. And it seems like it's hard for institutions to think ahead enough to understand that this would pay off in the long run. What is the plan? How do you talk to other institutions about kind of getting this off the ground?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think from the start, really the primary outcomes that we have followed have been patient-reported kind of outcomes and finances. So you have to build, if you want to change anything, you have to build a business case. You could, you just have to have a business case. So it just makes, it's good business. It's good business. Taking care of patients well is good business, but you know, you have to be more granular than that. It reduces length of stay. Length of stay was a big kind of pressure point for our institution just because it's always full and, you know, they were having to cancel surgeries and things like that. But also just costs. So we're funded from Medicare because it reduces costs by about 30%, at least in our kind of, we've done three phases of kind of analysis. So that's a lot of money. So I think the business case, and my advice, I guess, the take-home message is if you think you have something that's good for patients, you know, kind of telling the narrative that, you know, can you give me resources because this is good for patients? That's fine. Everyone wants to facilitate that, but it's just you got to have a business case.
And where are you seeing this? Can you outline a little bit more about the outcomes where you're seeing those cost savings? Is it shorter hospital stays? Is it less, you know, post-operative complications? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, we've never measured granular kind of like clinical outcomes. Like, as I said, we've cycled about 1,000 patients. Mm-hmm. You know, and complication rates are like 10 to 20%. So it's still not really that many patients. They go home sooner. I'm not exactly sure why, to be honest. And I think they kind of feel like the system is kind of taking care of them. And I think it's a pretty powerful thing. It's not just this program, but just using technology. It's actually the reason we got funded from Medicare because it's essentially a technology-based program. So it's very, it's cheap, I guess. It costs about $7 a patient. And then, I don't know.
I'd be interested to see, you know, now everything is based on rating your doctor and rating your institution. And I feel patients involved in one of these programs would feel much more affectionate for their institution, that it's not, they're not getting lost in this big institution. So it'd be interesting to see patient satisfaction scores before and after sort of an instrument like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, engaging your patient, positive psychology, all those things are critical for optimal outcomes. And I think, you know, in the surgical quality game, we do shenanigans like spend time making sure we give the antibiotics at the right time and all. You know, there's all these things that we kind of process stuff that we try to do or people try to make us do. And this is it's just a different approach. I think the two biggest areas where we're going to have an impact on surgical outcomes in the next 10 years is this. I think everyone's going to train. And two is kind of change the way we manage pain and opioids around surgery. I think those are two kind of open areas for opportunity.
So I have really two questions. One I wanted to ask, what you've learned by this, you know, these 1,000 patients, if they're for like the community surgeon out there who's not at a big, you know, institution that doesn't have this this built into their preoperative process, but they like the idea of it, and it seems to make very intuitive sense. What are some things, if you could give them a list of, if you had your patients do, you know, these three things preoperatively, you know, keep a record of how far they walk, or, you know, do this, this, and this, you should see a positive, you should see better outcomes.
Yeah, it's a great question. And we're taking the program on the road, so to speak, and trying to, you know, implement it in hospitals across Michigan. We come essentially with funding and lots of awesome staff to kind of start. It's still challenging because changing the way anyone, any surgeon process does their care is really hard. But I think that the three things is, I think having an advocate like an MA or a nurse in the clinic that really is kind of like a cheerleader, and having them educate the patient. I think the patient should get a pedometer and walk. I think the patients, you need to give them some advice on how to eat better. And I don't think, you know, people get hung up on the nutrition assessment, and that's all very important. But the bottom line is, I really think it's positive psychology. So if you tell any patient, take better care of yourself, what do they think? They think they need to eat better, first thing they think. They think they need to exercise more, and then if they have some bad habit like smoking, they need to quit smoking. So you need to explicitly say you need to exercise, you need to eat right, you need to quit smoking. But you have to kind of make it, like put a label on it and say, this is how we do surgery at this practice. Mm-hmm. And to be frank, if you don't do this program for a discretionary surgical case, we're not going to operate on you. Now, obviously, people need care, and some people aren't going to be empowered to do this. But, you know, bariatric surgery in the United States has unbelievable outcomes. And why? It's because patients are put into a program, mm-hmm. and that's rigid, and this is how you essentially earn the right to have bariatric surgery. And within that context, the outcomes are amazing. I think that's kind of, you kind of have to make it seem kind of formal. This is how we do it. And then I think that will kind of hopefully transform patients. I mean, big operations are such a pivot point for patients, and you can really change lifelong behavior. People will quit smoking. Like, holy moly, I have liver cancer. Yeah. You know, Dr. So-and-so is going to take out half my liver. Like, it's a captive audience, and you can do more than just hopefully cure their cancer. You can hopefully improve their lives long-term also. So that would be my general advice. Great question, though.
All right. Oh, that was great, sir. The next topic we want to talk about, we usually move into a tips and tricks segment where you can give us some, you know, how do you do things? And I know we talked earlier before we started the podcast, you thought maybe you could something to offer with an operating on patients that are, you know, are cirrhotic, and how do you approach a patient like that? Now, what are the important things to look at preoperatively and, you know, even intraoperatively?
Yeah, it's a great question. My clinical practice is liver transplantation. So if you're a liver transplant surgeon, you also frequently get referred general surgery, sometimes vascular surgery. Even you just help the gynecologist and urologist on patients who have cirrhosis. So it's actually a fun part of the job because you do operate a lot with kind of other types of surgeons. And your job is just kind of like to manage the bleeding part of it. So I think the common operations that cirrhotics come in your office, kind of, and who should you not operate on? If they come in, you know, in the middle of the night and they have a hole in their colon, you have to operate on them. But I think gallbladder disease and hernia are the two that I can comment on. If someone is a decompensated cirrhotic, that basically means platelet count less than 50, has ascites or encephalopathy, significant muscle wasting, then you really shouldn't do any discretionary operations on them. They're going to die in the near future of their liver disease. And there's a potential, and so you just basically say, I know, you know, they're frequently they'll come in saying, I'm so miserable, I need, will you care for me? And you definitely want to care for them, but you have to kind of explain to them that they're going to do worse with the operation. Why is that? Because if they have ascites and you fix their hernia, it will come back 100% of the time if they reaccumulated their ascites. So if you're going to fix a hernia on a cirrhotic, they have to essentially be ascites-free. Couple exceptions. Last Friday, I did an inguinal hernia on a guy with 6 liters of ascites. But so if someone's platelet count is less than 50, you shouldn't operate on them, or if they have any of those other things. I think there's almost never a reason to take a gallbladder out of a cirrhotic. If you find yourself about to do it, there's usually a better answer. I think a gallbladder stent through ERCP works really well. Every cirrhotic will have a gallbladder wall thickening. They'll frequently have kind of right upper quadrant pain. Just don't take out their gallbladder. They don't necessarily, the gallbladder, they barely make bile, you know, like they don't have classic biliary colic. And if you do, I mean, I'm not a great laparoscopic surgeon that doesn't, I could do a lap donor nephrectomy. It's my only operation. I can do laparoscopically very well, but you know, usually just do a kind of an open choline and take the thing out in about 3 minutes. But you should, the only time you should, I've ever like taken a gallbladder out of a cirrhotic is if someone started taking out a gallbladder out of a cirrhotic and then they had problems and they called the OR. So I guess my tidbits are, what's bad cirrhosis? Because 90% of cirrhotics, they're just like normal patients and you treat them. I think the 10% of people who are going to really do poorly are people who have thrombocytopenia, people with any kind of ascites, significant muscle wasting. If they're overtly jaundiced, bilirubin greater than 4, they're not going to do well. And you'll get them through the operation, but they just won't recover. And if you do find, you know, if you do an emergency operation on those people, then involve your hepatologist, I think. Don't give them any fluids. They're like cactuses. Just let them be cactuses. And I guess those are my tidbits.
Did you leave use mesh in the inguinal hernia you did?
Yeah. We'll see. 6 liters of ascites. I don't want. It's, we'll see. I've sprinkled pixie dust, so I think it's going to be okay.
So one of the classic things that always comes up is the umbilical hernia that comes into the ER in the cirrhotic. Maybe it's incarcerated, or you know, you see a little bit of skin thinning over the umbilicus. What do you do in that situation?
Paracentesis. If it's incarcerated and they're in severe pain. And yeah, you treat them like anyone who has a cruciate hernia, you probably have to operate on them. But if someone comes in with like, you know, their skin's about to pop or they're leaking ascites, you do a paracentesis, put them on antibiotics, get them, make sure they get good medical management of their cirrhosis. You don't operate on them. I mean, once in a while, you end up having to do it. I'd say 95% of the time, paracentesis, drain their ascites, get them on a bunch of diuretics. You could potentially even put a TIPS in if they tolerate it, if they're not, you know, if they don't have bad encephalopathy. And then sometimes you just at bedside you can stitch the skin closed, and that usually works. I think you just do what you can not to operate on them. I think is a good kind of rule of thumb. And if you have like a 60-year-old surgeon, you know, who's like kind of seen everything, it's the perfect time because to involve, you know, the like, you know, I'm a liver transplant surgeon. I'm 44 years old, but we have a Dr. Knoll in Ann Arbor who's kind of, you know, seen everything and. So, you know, frequently these common problems and people like that will just kind of run by Dr. Knoll. So
we're at the ASC meeting, and I was hoping you could just talk to us about briefly, you know, what the ASC has meant to you throughout your career and why you come to these meetings.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the first meeting I ever went to, I do a lot of academic stuff now, but I didn't as a medical student. I'm trained in Michigan, so kind of like there's an expectation you do a bunch of academic activities. My first meeting I ever came to was this meeting. And you know, I think when you come as a trainee, it's kind of intimidating to see all these people doing great work, and you're like, oh, I got to get my act together. And I think over the years, though, it's become, just a lot of fun. Like last night, I was, you know, just kind of seeing everyone having a lovely time, you know, at the reception. Many of my good friends I've met through the group, through this society, I think the most important thing about the meeting is it's a place where students and residents can come and see kind of what an amazing life being an academic surgeon is. It's such a rewarding, fulfilling thing. You can have, care for patients in their, you know, sickest time. You can do research and discover stuff. You can have an impactful life. And uniquely impactful life. You can just do it. It's just so rewarding. And I think it's hard because it's such a long journey between medical school and residency. It just is a lot of it's just kind of mud. So I think it's why I like to come is I like to essentially engage with trainees to get them as excited as they can be about kind of a life as an academic surgeon because it's I think it's the best job in the world. Definitely is the best job in the world.
Well, awesome, sir. Well, one question we've been asking everybody, if you can go back in time on your first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
That's a great question. I'm thinking of my first day of internship. Like my first task as a doctor was writing TPN on like, you know, a 5-kilogram baby. You know, you're just like, what the hell? What advice would I give myself? I think the learning clinical medicine, if I don't say comes easy, but that's a no-brainer, right? There's lots of patients, lots of great training programs. That's going to kind of come. I think the probably the most important thing is take care of yourself. you know, whatever that is, whatever that means, it's an individual thing for me. It was just kind of like exercise and stuff like that. And I was able to do that pretty well, but still, it's a grind, right? And it's a hard job. I think literally just kind of manage your wellness, because it's a long road. I mean, I did, you know, general surgery, I did transplant surgery fellowship, and it's kind of physically hard. So just kind of make sure that you kind of maintain your you know, whatever. I generally kind of think of it as fitness, because I think surgery is a physically demanding job. You guys know, you've been the trauma resident and run 15 miles, you know, run around the hospital taking care of everyone. So I think just take care of yourself.
Great. Dr. Inglesby, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's an honor.
All right, everyone, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. We have one other larger session called Failing Forward that was presented at the ASC that had a lot of the great surgeons in the field talking about their failures and how they overcame them, and we hope to bring that to you in the near future. So until next time, dominate the day.